Sunset Awe is a composition by my guest Teddy Edwards, who is featured on tenor, along with Duke Jordan at the piano, Larry Ridley bass, Freddie Waits drums, from an album on Xanadu Records called The Inimitable Teddy Edwards. Let me tell you a little bit about Teddy before we begin our conversation. He was born in Jacksonville, Mississippi.
Jackson, Mississippi.
After working with local bands there in the 1930s, he spent some time in Detroit and then moved to California. He subsequently played with Benny Carter, Clifford Brown and Max Roach, Benny Goodman. He also, during this period, led or co-led bands with Howard McGee. McGee and Teddy Edwards played together in an octet in the 1940s, along with Charlie Parker and Sonny Criss. He's recorded with Sonny Criss and with Benny Goodman, Sarah Vaughan, Ray Charles, Milt Jackson, Dexter Gordon, King Pleasure, among others. He's also written and arranged for Lorez Alexandria, who's also in the studio, and we'll be talking with her in a few minutes and also hearing some of her music. Teddy's also arranged and composed for Booker Irvin, Milt Jackson, Ray Charles. He's a featured soloist in the soundtracks for the films Any Wednesday and They Shoot Horses, Don't They? He's also the subject of a film that was produced by Steve Allen, who is also in Philadelphia this week and was on Fresh Air a little earlier in the week. Teddy's recent albums are featured on Xanadu Records, and recent reissues of his work are featured on Onyx Records, which is a subsidiary of Muse Records. Well, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a
pleasure
to have you here, and a pleasure to have you in Philadelphia.
Oh, it's going to be a really nice visit. I can see it coming.
Okay. What I'd like to do, Teddy, is like talk about the past and like work our way up to the present. Your family was a musical family. Your father was a trombonist.
My father played all of the popular instruments, trombone, trumpet, clarinet, violin, whatever, you know. But I never met my father until I was 12 years old, and I was already playing when I met him.
Oh.
Yeah, I lived with my grandparents, my mother and me, you know, and my grandfather played bass. In fact, he was one of the first acoustic bass players I ever heard. Most of the guys during that time, they were using the sousaphone or the tuba for the bass part, you know. He's really one of the pioneers of the string bass, really, in the jazz field.
What was his name?
Henry C. Reed.
Mm-hmm. Is he recorded?
No. That was before. He might have been on some of the old blues records, but you know, it's not of any repute.
Did he teach you how to play your first instrument?
No, what happened was there was a saxophonist living at my house. But before that, my mother and my grandmother, they talked saxophone to me before I even started school. They had brainwashed me about saxophone because my father played, and they had me idolizing my father, you know. And the band used to rehearse at my house, and they would sit me by the saxophone section, you know, way before I started school. So I was saxophone brainwashed, you know. So eventually, the fellow that was living with us, he had a second instrument, and my mother bought it from him, and she washed and ironed his clothes to pay for my lessons, which were 35 cents a week. And after 6 months, he told me, he said, well, look, I don't know anything else to teach you, you know. So you're on your own. So I was on my own up until 1948. I did 3 months of study in Los Angeles. Until then, it was all a matter of trial and error and listening to people and listening to music and studying the best that I could on my own.
You, when you started playing, I think, also played clarinet.
Right. Well, I took up the clarinet around about 14 on my own, and I had started studying orchestration. In fact, I wrote my first regular dance band orchestration that the notes came out right when I was 14.
Wow. Do you play clarinet anymore? It seems to be an instrument that's like faded from contemporary jazz.
It's
mostly
such a hard instrument. You know, it asks for your blood, believe me. It looks simple, but it's a very difficult instrument. So a lot of people shy away from it. Like, when I came along, you almost had to play like Sonny Stitt and Wardell, Rudy Ruther. We were all fine clarinet players for that, you know, when we came up around Detroit. But somehow, the guys just started leaving it alone. You know, because you got to practice it every day hard, else it'll let you know, you know.
When you started playing in bands before you moved to the West Coast, what kind of bands were they? What kind of music did you play?
Well, the first band I played in was Doc Pomin and his Royal Mississippi, and that was an 18-piece orchestra, all adults, you know. It was no child's orchestra. And I was playing third, and before long I was playing the lead. And I played with another band around home named Don Dunbar. Good band, had good writers, you know.
How old
were you then? I was like 13 and 14. I first took my first tour when I was 12, went out on the road with a band.
Now, that's really young. I mean, it doesn't seem like jazz musicians get started that young anymore. I don't see any anymore.
Well, nowadays they are starting them out young because they have the good teachers and the good equipment and everything. But I really did it the hard way, but I was determined. You know, to play that instrument.
Well, what was life like for you? I could see you like showing up at a bar and then, you know, like be, you know, playing in a place where there's alcohol. But you know, if it was a bar or something,
well,
like not being able to drink.
Well, in those days, they didn't have any laws about children not being able to come in.
Yeah,
you know, I worked
all
kind of places with different people, little combos and what have you, and it didn't matter, you know.
Well, you got a little older and then
I went to Detroit when I was about 16, and I worked the finer clubs around there, some of the really fine jobs, you know, because I could play very good for a youngster, you know. And I had the better jobs around Detroit when I was a kid, 16 years old. You know, that was before, when Yusuf Lateef and Milt Jackson, all of them, they're just trying to get the act together, you know. Sonny Stitt was around there, Wardell, Lucky Thompson. But I seen them had a little jump on all of them, maybe except Rudy Rutherford, the clarinetist, Rudy Rutherford and Sonny Stitt. They had a little bit more experience than I had at the time, you know. But we all came up around there pretty much the same period, early 40s. In fact, I was the first guy to teach Yusuf Lateef to change to a song.
When did you start, learning bop and learning the whole new jazz language, because you were playing when you were 12 and there was
during that period when this thing was in its embryo stage. I was out on the road with different bands and guys like Charlie Parker. He was with Max Shan and then Andy Kirk, different bands they had. So we used to meet up out on the road and this thing, when it was first started to make the change, well, I just happened to be in the change. You see, so the best thing I had going for me was that I had a good harmonic knowledge. I studied harmony real early. You know, when I first heard guys talking about guys playing chord styles, I said, well, let me look into that, you know. So I learned the chords. That's a very valuable thing. You learn those chords thorough as soon as you can when you take up music, because that's one of the main ingredients of music. Well, it's the number three ingredients. First is rhythm, next is melody, then the harmony. Learn the harmony, push your way ahead.
When you started playing with Howard McGee. How did you meet up with him?
Well, I had met Howard in Detroit. We came out of the same band in Detroit at the Congo Club playing for the Top X, you know, in Detroit. And I left. My mother took a second. I went down to Mississippi, and I ventured down into Florida, down into Tampa with the band. And I ended up being the leader when the leaders were drafted. They appointed me the leader. I was on about, I was 20 years old at that time. And I think that's when Cannonball Adderley his brother and Sam Jones and Buster Cooper and all of them used to stand around outside to listen to me play. You know, you're too young to come in. But anyway, I ventured down through there, and then I left, and Andy Kirk was looking for me. Howard McGee's with Andy Kirk's band. So I ventured out to California with Ernie Fields Orchestra. In fact, I was supposed to be on my way to New York, and he talked me into joining his band because he said, well, we're going to Washington, and you just... you'll have more money when you get to New York. I said, well, that makes a lot of sense. You know, he said, the guys in the band heard you play and they want you with the band. I said, oh, good. So my first stop was Pensacola. The next one was Monroe, Louisiana. Then Tulsa, Oklahoma. Lincoln, Nebraska, getting farther and farther away from New York. Next stop, Los Angeles.
Is that how you got to L.A.?
Right, that's how I got to L.A. Yeah,
did you stay there?
With Ernie Fields Orchestra. I was playing lead alto with his band. And I left. I came in 44, and then I left. I had a very bad cold, and the bus broke down up above Cheyenne, Wyoming. And I had a bad cold. I said, well, now, I'm not going to survive this cold. I'm going to go into bad health. I'm going back to California. So when I got to Dodge City, Kansas, I called Roy Milton. He had told me, the blues singer, he had told me, anytime you get ready, come back to Los Angeles. I'll get you in the union and everything. I said, well, that's where I'm going. I called him, came back to Los Angeles. That's been my home base ever since. Now, Howard McGee, he was out here with Coleman Hawkins Orchestra at Billy Berg's, one of the fine clubs in Hollywood at the time. And when they finished the job, Coleman went back to New York, and Howard wanted to stay in Los Angeles and form a band. And he couldn't find any tenor players that had the knowledge that he needed to do what he was doing. So he told me, he said, looks like you're going to have to change and started playing tenor, you know, because I want you with the band. So I was eager. I said, well, good. I got a tenor and started playing tenor with his group, you know.
You'd been playing alto?
I've been playing alto and clarinet up until that time, which was 1945.
What was the year or years, the period of time that you and Howard McGhee and Charlie Parker played
that
together?
That was 1946, during the record band. We had I had four saxophones and a trumpet. You know, we had Sonny Chris, G. Montgomery, and Charlie Parker and I. We were the saxophone section. And we had Bob Kesterson, Earl Eklund playing piano, and Roy Porter playing drums, and Howard McGhee playing the trumpet.
Did you ever get to record with that group?
Didn't record with that band, you know.
Why?
Well, it was during the record band. We weren't allowed to record during that period. It was, union thing.
Oh, another one of those bands one of those that were things, completely passed
yeah,
over.
Yeah, completely lost. That was ridiculous because it was such a great outfit.
What was it like playing with Charlie Parker?
Well, we had played together way before that. You were like jamming together every night, you know, different places. And he was probably the most magnetic individual I ever met. And besides playing music, he knew so many other things. People don't have any idea how brilliant this man was. Walter Winchell knew, because he called him the eighth wonder of the world, because of his knowledge of many different things, not just music, you know. And a memory, like you wouldn't believe his memory, you know. In fact, the first time I sung with Billy Eckstein's band, they had been together 4 days. I saw him on the fourth day down in Lakeland, Florida, and he was sitting on the library. After 4 days, he's sitting on the book. That's how his mind was. You know?
I think he moved back to... Where were you playing when you were together, the Octet?
We were in Los Angeles, but the last time he was in San Francisco... I took him to the train station. His last day on California soil, because I was working at Bob City in San Francisco, and he was working at the same wind. I was working after hours. When he finished his gig, he would come and play with me. So when I get off at 6, we would go and play chess all day. He loved to play chess, and we would just sit over the chessboard the rest of the day practically.
Then he came east after that.
Yeah, right. He came into Chicago and into New York after that.
Mm-hmm. And the growth of bebop and all of this is usually something that... associated with New York and with the East Coast. Were you ever tempted to, come back east?
That was one of my mistakes, because I didn't leave when everybody else was gone. But see, what was happening, John Coltrane and Jimmy Heath and Stanley Turner, you know, they were back east studying me, you see, because I was way ahead of the tenor players in 1945 and 46. If you check out my Up in Dodo's room with Howard McGhee, that's the first record that a tenor player made that didn't come from the Lester Young or the Coleman Hawkins School. In fact, I wasn't aware of it until Fash Navarro told me, "Man, do you realize you changed the course of history?" I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Blues and up in Dodo's room." He said, "That's the first one to come up playing different." Then here comes the rest of them, you know, Sonny Rollins and James Moody and all of them after that one. You know, they heard that sound. But I was out here and wasn't getting the publicity from New York, you know. But right today, Stan and his brothers, Milt Jackson, Percy Heath, all those guys can sing all those solos note for note that I recorded back around 45 and 46.
Do you listen to those records still?
No.
Do you
I
have
can't
cabbies
stand
over?
To hear them.
Well, why?
Well, I was a struggling kid of 21 at the time on instrument.
Do you have people who you consider to be your influences, or do you think that your style's about pretty independent?
Well, I actually... I never really copied anybody to any degree at all, because the way I really started as a soloist, the pianist could call the chords to me, and I could transpose them to my instrument as fast as he would call them, and I would just play up and down until eventually I got so I could make them make sense and start hearing it. But my early idols were Johnny Hodges was my first idol, Benny Carter, Willie Smith. Oh, I could go on and on, you know, Johnny Bothwell. I could go on naming saxophone, Tab Smith. The alto players were my thing, you know. Naturally, I admired Lester Young and Coleman Hawkins and John Chuberry and all those guys, you know. And later on, the later said Dexter and Wardell and all them. But I imagine the whole scene had influenced me. You know, I just came up with the scene, you know, just came up as part of it. But actually, as far as me really trying to play like somebody, never have I tried to do that. You know, because I had the harmonic thing going, and I could just do what I could do until I could make it make sense, you know.
Teddy, before we continue our conversation, I'd like to go back to the recording that we've been listening to and play another track from
Why
it.
Why not?
This is a track of That Old Black Magic. And again, Teddy Edwards is featured on tenor sax, Duke Jordan at the piano, Larry Ridley bass, and Freddie Waite's drums. Would you want to say a few words about this, Teddy, before we hear it?
About this particular date? Nothing in particular. It's just went into New York and did one of those Xanadu albums, you know.
Okay, well, let's hear this recording of that old Black Magic. We've just heard that old Black Magic as featured on a Xanadu recording called The Inimitable Teddy Edwards, who was featured on tenor sax. Teddy Edwards is my guest in the studio now. Well, Teddy, we had been talking a little bit about some of the bands that you've played with. Now, you've played in bands that were led by other people, and you've led your own band, so you've kind of been on both ends of that. Sometimes when I'm reading, when I'm reading a book written by like a jazz critic or historian or something, they'll sometimes refer to the band leader as like the employer, which
from an academic point of view, he is the employer. But now music. You play music together. If I'm the lead of a group, I'm just part of the group, really. I just happen to be the one officiating the business. But the music you play together, you know. So if you're playing with me, I'm playing with you. You play with, not for.
Well, what's your attitude towards the people who are playing in a band with you, as far as like the kinds of rules or whatever you're gonna like set down?
Well,
for
the first
by
place, the guys that I would choose, I would feel that they were pretty much responsible and try to create an atmosphere where everybody is eager to give their best. That's the main function of a leader, is to get the best out of the people around him. Else, he's not a leader. And so he's a so-called leader. Now, there's guys that are, slave drivers and all of that, but they don't get the best out of the people. See, people have to want to do for you to play music. They got to want to play it, else you don't get the best out of them, you know? And we were talking a few minutes ago about one of my good friends from way back, very fine pianist and songwriter. He wrote one of Nat Cole's hits, and he was also the owner of the company that Larez and I did some work for. In fact, one of her better albums is on his Pizzazz label, defunct Pizzazz label. His name is Paul Gayton. And he's a great pioneer of talent. Annie Laurie, remember Since I Fell for You?
Yeah.
That was one of his big ones, and he's really a great guy. And Larez was asking me about how soon did I play with Paul. Well, I played with Paul when I was 14 in his band called Paul Gayton and his Sizzling Six. We had a little sextet, you know. And
he sang himself.
And he's a great singer also, yeah. So great band. He's some of the final musicians, Hank Mobley, a lot of them came out of his band. And
We were talking a bit about the kind of leader that you are when you're the leader of a band.
Well, I don't like to feel that I'm the leader. I'm just one of the guys. You know, we gang up on the music. You know, naturally, I have to make sure things maintain a certain amount of order for us to get a certain amount of continuity. But as far as me really want to be a leader, you know, I just come to work and have some fun, you know. Like, I just performed a concert not too long ago with 18 pieces. We just had a ball. Then I did one last year, July the 1st last year, with 32 pieces. That I did the orchestration, lyrics, composition, the whole works. And we're just like one big happy family, you know.
Well, you've played with a lot of people, some of whom's attitude might not be what yours is towards leading a band. Can you compare like your attitude with someone?
Let me key in on one of the most famous band leaders, Benny Goodman. Now, Benny Goodman has a reputation for having what they call the Ray. All musicians know about the Ray. The Ray is the way he looks at you on the bandstand. You know, you get those daggers going. You know, so Benny, the first time I worked with Benny, I came to rehearsal, and all the musicians were sitting outside because he was playing with the rhythm section. See, before he performs, he plays the rhythm section, then he brings the band in. Right, we in Hollywood, all the big-time musicians sitting outside, afraid to go in the room. So I walked on there and said, wait a minute, he's just got to be another man. So I walked on in and took a seat. And set my horn down, you know. And he looked over at me, you know. And then when he finished, then he, you know, I went over and introduced myself to him because I never worked with him. But all these big-time musicians, all they can do is lose the gig, you know. They're afraid to come in into the place where the man was, waiting until he finished before they would even open the door, you know. But anyway, to make a long story short, through the process, we became very good friends, you know. In fact, I really think it loosened him up quite a bit, our relationship. Really loosened him up because he smiled and he was nice to the guys and everything, you know. And one day in New York, he had just finished blowing his top and he looked at me, he says, how can you sit there and be so relaxed when I'm a nervous wreck? I said, Benny, you got to learn how to roll with the punches, man. He said, you know, you got something there, you know. So, yeah, it's not that important, you know. You got to roll with the punches, you know. And it really helped him to relax. In fact, he had an occasion to really be stiff once. We worked the Melody Land, and Peggy Lee, whom he discovered, had top billing over him, and it kind of messed with his ego a little bit until they played the overture and the people gave him all that applause, then that relaxed him, you know. But at first, he had cause to be, because she had no business having top. She shouldn't have accepted top billing over him, You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because of what he had done for her and what he had been in the business, you know. But business people, they go with who's on top at the time, and it's a matter of business, but these things happen, you know. But anyway, I just want to relay that little experience with you. But he was what you call the hard band leader. You know, rehearsal is like the gig to him. No fun or nothing, you know. It's strictly hard business. But eventually he worked his way out of that, you know.
Do you think you have to be looser? Because you're saying before, you know, you've got to... everyone has to, like, want to play well.
To get the best out of people, you know. They have to want to do it. To give you that extra something, the extra dimension that money cannot buy. You can get it from musicians if you show them respect and show them that you care about them and what they are doing.
Now, you've also played, like, for TV studio bands.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering what that's like, because from my end, which is the end in my living room, where you just, like, turn on the TV.
Well, that's strictly hard, cold business, you know. Uh-huh. If you don't play it the second time, somebody will be there to take your place. You can miss the first time, but the second time, you got to play it. You see? That's how tough it is. You know, it's strictly by the minute. And it's like a 9-to-5 job. It's very little fun. You know, playing that type of really studio music. You know, now and then you get some music that you enjoy playing. And so they be so happy when they run into a piece of music to play for somebody behind a singer, but the arrangement is good, with substance, you know. Like, they really pay the musicians cheap. See, the musicians, when you look up that at the night show, when you look at that band, you're looking at more brains than you see on that show the rest of the night. But they don't respect those brains, because they just musicians, just another tool. But it's more brain sitting up on that bandstand than it is out there behind that desk. You can believe that.
Well, it also seems to me like, you know, in my living room, if I'm watching The Tonight Show or any of those, like, talk shows where you know there's some good people mm-hmm. in the band, but they never get to play. It's like they're more interested in Flash. And
you know,
a
you notice you never see a musician on any game show or talk show or anything as a guest. Only one, Buddy Rich. Now, that's ridiculous. No kind of game show. You don't see musicians on them. You know, and musicians are some of the most experienced people there is. But somehow they just keep shoving them aside like they're twos, you know. But they are the foundation of the business. Without the music, what you going to do?
Really,
you know?
Yeah.
You know, invisible man.
Right, the invisible man, you know. And they really, really need to learn to respect that, you know.
You've been recording recently for Xanadu Records. How did you get hooked up with him?
Don Slidden. Well, he was my producer at Prestige when I was with Prestige. I was on a contract to Prestige, and then he was my producer at Muse when I was with Muse. And then he got his own label together, Xanadu. He approached me about doing some things for him, and so we've had a long relationship. Don Slidden, the producer over there. In fact, he told me that my It's All Right that I did with a sextet. He sent me a magazine article where he stated that. He had more fun making that record than any record, and he's recorded everybody you can think of on Prestige. He said that was
That's
his choice of the records that he had recorded. Was my sextet thing with Cedar Walton and Jimmy Owens, and well, you know the one I'm talking about.
Yeah.
It's All Right, that Emma.
Teddy, I want to thank you very much.
Hey, it's
for
been
spending
my pleasure.
Time here on Fresh
Karen,
Air.
Karen, you're doing a very, very fine job. Believe
thank you.
Me. And thanks to WUHY.
Okay, well, I've been speaking with Teddy Edwards, and in just a few minutes we're going to speak with Larez Alexandria and hear some of her recordings. But first we're going to hear another track from the Xanadu record, the inimitable Teddy Edwards. This is a recording of Stella by Starlight. Thank you.
Thank you.
We've just heard Teddy Edwards' recording of Stella by Starlight. Now, tomorrow night, he's going to be performing along with Lorez Alexandria. Lorez is in the studio with me now. And again, before I speak with her, why don't we listen to some of her music? She is a vocalist, as you are about to hear, and from a recent album, which is called How Will I Remember You, we're going to hear a real nice version of Make Someone Happy.
One, two, three, four. If you would only make someone happy, I try to make that one someone happy. Make just one heart to heart you sing to. One smile that cheers you, one face that lights as it nears you, one man. You are everything. Cause fame, if you win it, seems to come and go in a minute. Where's the real stuff in life to cling to? I think that love is the answer. Just that one man to love is the answer. If and when you found him, commence, begin to build your world around him. You can make some. Try to make that one someone happy. You would find it's easy. You can be happy too.
Alexandria from her album How Will I Remember You. Before we start talking, let me tell you a little bit about her. She was born and raised in Chicago. She started singing gospel in the church. Her recording career began in 1957. Since 1961, she's lived in Los Angeles. This is her first East Coast appearance in, I think, 10 years, Lorez?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Her most recent album is the one that we just heard an excerpt of called How Will I Remember You. It's on a label called Discovery Records. She's recorded a number of other records, including Lorez Sings Prez, The Great Lorez Alexandria on Impulse Records, and Didn't We, an album on Pizzazz. Again, Lorez is going to be performing along with Teddy Edwards tomorrow night at the International House, and we're going to be giving away a couple of sets of tickets to that performance in a few minutes. Welcome to Fresh Air, Lorez.
Thank you so much, Terry.
I'd like to, again, like start backwards a little bit and talk a little bit about the influence of gospel singing, of singing in the church on your jazz singing. I don't know which you'd say had the greater influence on you, what you heard later of jazz or, you know, your early singing in the church.
I absolutely cannot really call myself a gospel singer. I was never really a gospel singer. I sang in the church, but I sang with an a cappella group. I did any number of different kinds of things. A cappella work is the most exacting work. It develops the ear greatly. You have no instrument to cover up any mistakes. And I was fortunate enough to be under the leadership of a very, very fantastic man, Reverend Luce Allen, who taught a cappella work totally sans music. You never looked at a lyric. You learned the words and the harmonic parts without the benefit of any music, which means it stuck and mm-hmm. it stayed there. And he taught me how to direct and how to teach this type of music, which is what I'd like to do someday, really. I love that type of choral work. I think it's the most beautiful sound. It's like a wall of harmony if it's taught properly. The transition was one that didn't come totally as a surprise to me. I knew that I wanted to do something other than that with my singing. So I began to sing weekends with a local band in Chicago, just feeling my way along, just really trying to find out which direction I wanted to go in. Into. I hadn't really thought of jazz as an entity for myself when I first started singing. I just knew I wanted to sing. And when I began to realize that this was the direction in which I was heading, because I wasn't singing orthodox enough to be a pop singer. It never appealed to me to sing boom, 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 tada, ding, ding, ding. I never thought that way. The cadence wasn't there. I don't think that, well, some singers think that way, orderly in their mind, and, you know, they can do it exactly the same way every time. But I don't speak that way. I don't think that way. My thoughts are kind of jump out at you. So I began to practice on a tape recorder, one of the first Wilcox gates, great big heavy thing. That was given to me as a gift, you know, and I began to listen to myself. And I was so bad, it was frightening. And I said to myself, I'll never make it. I will never be able to emerge as a real identity in this business, because at that time, what I was hearing, and the very best in the business, Billie Holiday and Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan, Carmen McRae, these people were so polished and so great. I said, well, I don't ever want to be mediocre doing anything. I will either have to get much better at this or I will have to give it up. So I proceeded to really diligently try to emerge with a sound of my own from all these great people, because as much as I admired them, I didn't want to sound like any of them, because you can't get any place saying, you know that girl that sounds like Sarah Vaughan, you know that girl. Your name is never mentioned. It's that person who sounds like.
So how do you do that? You know, like, how did you go about finding what was your style?
Well, it actually is not such a totally difficult thing to do if you realize that there's no way in the world that you can do this without sounding a little bit like somebody else. You must, but you cannot take it like rote. You can't take it note for note. You take the best from all of them. Like, you feel that swing from Ella. You feel that technique from Sass, phrasing from Carmen McRae and Billie Holiday. It's a conglomerate thing. It's a fusion type thing from all of these people. And out of it, you emerge yourself, because you bring to it yourself, your feeling, your interpretation of a lyric, which has to be your own. I don't care how much you're influenced by these people, and you have to be influenced by them, because they're the pathfinders. They laid out the route for you. And so this is how it happened, the transitional period. Of course, you learn things over the years that apply just to you as an individual.
Go ahead.
It's all right, Terry.
How do you go about choosing the songs that you're going to sing? What attracts you to a song, both musically and in terms of its lyrics?
Well, actually, I'm a lyric person. Lyrics are very important to me. And it's a story that you're trying to tell. And if the story doesn't make sense, then I can't tell it. It's just that simple. I'm very ticky about lyrics. And I will live with a lyric. If it's musically, if it's melodic, then that's no problem, because being a singer who interprets the music rather than singing right notes, I drive Teddy crazy with that, because Teddy is really a technician, and sometimes I don't want to hit the note exactly the way he's written it. It'll be right within the framework of the chord structure, but Teddy will say, no, Larez, that is not, well, I know that, Teddy, but I hear it here, you know. I never really, from just the beginnings that I told you about, I listened to more instrumentalists than I ever did vocalists. I always felt that freedom that an instrumentalist has, that a lot of singers don't venture out to do that. Ella, of course, does it. But I hear more with a musician's ear than with, wouldn't you say so, Teddy? Really?
All the small singers listen to good horn players.
That's right. That's right. They do. They really do. And I think that I'm no exception to that. And so I was really more influenced by a lot of the people that were playing, you know, than were singing after the initial...
Is that where in your mind one of the things that separates, like, the jazz singer from the pop singer? That the pop singer will, like, sing the sheet music and the jazz singer will, like, really interpret a song?
Right. I think they hear it further than a pop singer. They hear the overall thing more than a pop singer. A pop singer is more concerned, I think, with how the voice is overshadowing the rest of it. But I think it's more of a marriage type thing with musicians and jazz singers.
Well, let's hear another track from the album, How Will I Remember You. This is actually, we're going to hear How Will I Remember You. Do you want to say a few words about this song?
Yes. Albert Marks, who is the producer of my albums now on Discovery Records, is a man who's been in the business for a good many years. As a matter of fact, he was the first one to record Sarah Vaughan back in 1942. And he knew Carl Sigman. He knows Carl Sigman. And he knew Walter Gross, who wrote Tenderly. Walter Gross, before his death, made the statement that he thought How Will I Remember You was a better piece of material than Tenderly. And that Mr. Marks paid me the compliment of saying that he wished that Mr. Gross was alive to see hear my treatment of the piece of material.
Well, that's something we'll have the pleasure of hearing right now.
Thank you.
By the welcome in your arms, and what about this heart you broke? How will I remember you? And a touch that carried me away out into space somewhere. Come back to me. Come back. Nearly all the time. 'Cause
Larez Alexandria's recording of How Will I Remember You from an album on Discovery Records by the same name. Let me remind you that this is Fresh Air and that you're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia and that Larez Alexandria is in the studio with me now and that tomorrow night she and Teddy Edwards will be performing at the International House in Philadelphia, which is at 3701 Chestnut Street. We're going to be giving away now a couple of sets of tickets to that concert. There's two sets, one at 8 and one at 11, so we're going to give away a pair of tickets for each set. And what we'll do is the first two people who call will get a set of tickets, for one for the 8 and one for the 11. So let me give you a phone number. Our phone number is Evergreen 76660. You can call now. The first two people who call that phone number who express an interest in the tickets will receive it, and we'll take care of that. By the way, again, that performance is tomorrow night. Well, I'm in the studio with Larez Alexandria, and we're going to have a few more minutes to talk before you have to get going.
Wonderful.
Okay. We were talking a little before about jazz singing and pop singing. Mm. I'm wondering if you've recorded with strings and what your feelings are about recording with strings. There was a period particularly in the, I guess, late 50s, early 60s when it was almost obligatory, I think, for singers to record with strings. And almost every jazz singer had at least one album with strings.
Well, I was with Argo Records for a while, which was the jazz label of Chess Records. And they did record some things with strings. Single Sad Songs for Me has some strings on it. I wasn't particularly pleased with it. They were in the studio with me. I'd rather record without the strings being in the studio and having them later, because I have to have a certain amount of freedom. I think that a lot of times in writing, you're boxed in so that you don't phrase with quite as much freedom, or you don't have the type of feeling. That's only me. A lot of other people are able to do it very well, and it doesn't bother them. I can only speak about how it affects me to be boxed in like that. I don't like to be boxed in. I like to have that type of freewheeling thing. And then if they want to lay the track on, sometimes it works out very well. I haven't thus far done with this label here. I have a whole lot of freedom as to choice of how I want things done. I'm sure that in the very near future I will be doing, because I intend to do a Gershwin songbook, and who's one of my favorite composers. And Mr. Marx has expressed his willingness to finance that type of venture. So we're feeling our way along. We're new together, and he has the utmost confidence in my choice of material and what I want to do. So I'm very happy with the association up to now.
How do you